Sorry for the interruption. We're back again now, and on with where we were at. I forgot who was saying.
Oh, I was saying I'm not blaming Israel for the attack. I'm just saying it looks like they are one of the players in it. Of course, what role anyone plays is anyone's guess, but what it reminds me of, 9/11 is like that King David Hotel where they put explosives in a building, pretended to be Arabs, and tried to generate anger towards Arabs. And see, what I see as a possibility is that the Carlyle Group and all these others that you're talking about may have had all these plans, but if they asked some help from Israelis, don't you think the possibility is the Israelis will say, well, this is a great plan. Here, let's just change it a little and have it so that you're directing your anger towards the Arabs so that we benefit too.
Well, again, I find that, you know, speculative. You see, I think this is much closer to Kristallnacht than, you know, the Nazis used prior or, you know, to the Second World War to blame the Israelis for an attack on the Reichstag and then ultimately use that as justification for the concentration camps and so on. I mean, you've got to look at what strategic targets were taken out. And determine who would have benefited. There's a Latin phrase, qui bono, who benefits.
Well, that's right, and who benefits?
Now, in the case of who benefits, for example, we know, without a shadow of a doubt, that UBS and the investors in UBS, the world's largest private bank with $2 trillion of money under management for private and wealthy individuals in Switzerland, benefited hugely with its investors as a result of the 9/11 attack by being long in New York and short in Chicago, and two families, very powerful families, that in fact ran the world's most efficient assassination networks, the Saddam Hussein family through his half-brother Baz and al-Tikriti in Geneva, who was hanged in Baghdad a few weeks ago, and fortunately they used too long a rope and pulled his head off. So Saddam Hussein's family and the thugs in the Ba'ath Party were heavily invested through UBS in the attack of 9/11 or the panic in the New York Stock Exchange. And the second group of investors through Yeslam bin Laden, also in Geneva, and a great buddy of Baz and al-Tikriti, they were both investing, it would appear, in a small, well, it's not that small, a private bank in Switzerland called Pargesa, Paribas Genève Société Anonyme, controlled by Paul Demeret of the Carlyle Group.
Now, you say Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attack?
Yes.
He was in it, involved with the Carlyle Group and all the others, but then they ended up hanging him?
No.
Yeah, because they could. There's a double cross here, you see. What happened is that the Iraqi intelligence services and the Ba'ath Party bosses were all profiting from the United Nations oil for food scam. And I want to register with you guys my absolute contempt for the United Nations. It is a dysfunctional and corrupt, racketeering, influenced and corrupt organization that would try and tell us, we sheep, that we should be paying these clowns $50 a ton for the right to breathe out carbon dioxide at some future date. And that scam is run by the likes of Al Gore. Right? So the United Nations, in my opinion, the very, very best thing that the United States could do is kick the United Nations out of New York and send them anywhere but America. Because what you're getting with the United Nations is what Thomas Jefferson, your great American president, warned you against, is entangled alliances. Nothing that you do with the United Nations has any clarity. It has no moral clarity, it has no financial clarity, there's no accountability. It's run by a group of despots. When Baz and al-Tikriti, who was the head of Iraqi intelligence for Saddam Hussein and a ruthless killer, he was sent to Geneva. Right? And do you know what his new job was? His great, great career change. It was permanent representative for the Iraqi delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission.
Well, if Saddam was involved, I mean, this was during the years that we had an embargo on Iraq I mean, the 90s, he was completely under embargo. How would he be getting involved in 9/11 if our embargo
was... Well, because embargo, as is always the case, it wasn't working, and they found ways around the embargo. And let me... Did you ever hear of the scandal called Iraq Gate?
I think I heard of that one, too.
Okay, Iraq Gate... No, let me just explain. The Iraq Gate scandal was the shipping of cluster bomb technology from the United States through the Lake Erie and the Welland Canal along the St. Lawrence Seaway into Europe for relabeling and on into Iraq so it could be used during the Iran-Iraq War, because at that time people felt that the greatest threat to the stability in the Middle East were the waves of suicide attackers from Iran into Iraq. So Saddam needed anti-personnel weapons, and Americans had developed some cluster bomb technology that Saddam needed, and it would appear that the CIA was shipping this cluster bomb technology through the United States into Canada using a front company called Lafarge, which is the world's largest cement company. And fast forward, we'll demonstrate that Lafarge, with expert in incineration, is very efficient at destroying organic and inorganic material that might be used in a prosecution for an insurance fraud. Anyway, be that as it may, this alleged cluster bomb smuggling pipeline, fronted by Lafarge and I believe Canada Steamship Lines, was where they'd hand over the equipment in the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is controlled by the former Prime Minister of Canada and Carlisle. Lafarge was threatened with exposure of this shipping material, a banned material, prescribed material to Saddam, and in 1990 they appointed a director to protect their pipeline. Any ideas what that director was?
No.
It was Hillary Clinton.
Oh.
Hillary Clinton. So from 1986 to 1992, Hillary Clinton introduced dead peasant life insurance to Walmart, where she was a director. And in 1990 to 1992, when she was a partner of the Rose Law Firm, which would go on to provide the missile gyroscopes used on 911 and the encrypted virtual private networks that were used to sabotage military communications on 911, it would appear she was responsible for maintaining the shipment of incendiary cluster bombs to Saddam Hussein and Barzan al-Tikriti, his half-brother, in Iraq, in order to facilitate the killing of Iranian human wave attackers coming over the Shatt al-Arab waterway.
Oh yeah, I can understand us giving him technology and weapons. We did that, but what about how would he be involved in 9/11? What would the involvement be? Just money or?
Well, remember in the 1993 attacks. Well, when in the Gulf War I, basically that is you and a whole bunch of other countries, blew Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, right?
Right, and bombed a lot of their cities, right.
And he wanted revenge. Now, the U.S. Department of State prevented George Bush Sr. going from all the way to Baghdad, which in my opinion was an absolutely treasonous act, because had George Bush Sr. gone all the way to Baghdad, he wouldn't be faced with this problem now. And because they didn't eliminate Saddam's intelligence service and apparatus for killing Iraqi fellow citizens, the Shiites who had rebelled against Saddam and his Sunni socialists, they were massacred. And that, amongst others, that's the reason why Barzan al-Tikriti was hanged for crimes against humanity and genocide. So basically, George Bush Sr.'s campaign to go to Baghdad and overthrow this despotic, fascist, disgusting regime was thwarted by people inside the United States Department of State, which I think was Colin Powell, amongst others. Now, by leaving Saddam alone, and by using the opportunity to steal the papers and identifications of dead Kuwaitis who Saddam's intelligence services killed, they were able to equip a number of senior Iraqi agents with false identity, and two of those agents was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Youssef, who entered the United States on an Iraqi passport and proceeded to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993, using advanced and sophisticated technology, including atomized aluminum powder of the kind that I believe Hillary Clinton had helped to protect with the Rose Law Firm for her incendiary cluster bombs that were sent to Iraq. So I think we can demonstrate, merely by tracing the special weapons and technologies using in the attack on 911 and on 1993, because Ramzi Youssef used 100 pounds of atomized aluminum powder, which is a very characteristic signature used by the Unabomber. You remember the Unabomber?
Right, yes.
Right, the Unabomber, from his third device onwards to his 18th device, every one of those bombs contained atomized aluminum powder to boost the temperature and devastation of the attack. And those were attacks on universities and airlines.
Yeah, there's someone that said that somebody has a website that doesn't believe made those bombs. Somebody else made them.
Right, and the FBI did a profile, and they discovered there was zero correlation between the fingerprints on the devices attributed to the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, and the fingerprints on the mail packages that were sent to warn, in some cases, the victims that they were about to be sent a parcel that could kill them or injure them. So it looks like the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, who was actually put into maximum security jail, guess who his cell, not his cellmates, but on either side of Ted Kaczynski, on one side was Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, yeah, I think I heard that.
On the other side, Eric, was Ramzi Youssef.
Oh.
Right? Now, he was the bomber, the expert bomber, the Iraqi agent of 1993. So what you have is Iraqi intelligence services had set up an al-Qaeda structure with insiders inside the Clinton administration. So it looked like al-Qaeda attacks, but the expert side of it was state-sponsored terrorism run through the Iraqi intelligence services.
So then the Iraqis were saying they're playing more than just, their role is actually more significant in the bombing of 1993 and 1991. It's not just, good luck. They're not just wishing good luck, they're actually involved in it.
Absolutely, because Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is an Iraqi agent, he's got his papers have all been forged after the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, because they killed a whole bunch of Kuwaitis and they were able to get access to their social insurance numbers and passport numbers, etc. So they created a very sophisticated legend for these guys, but they were Iraqi agents. What Iraq wanted was revenge, obviously, for the attack where the Brits and the Americans and Canadians threw Iraq out of Kuwait. And they used the occupation of Kuwait to develop a number of agents with false identities. And remember, the attack on 911, what we have to understand, was a very, very sophisticated attack. You get that with state-sponsored terrorism. You don't get that with a bunch of losers who've been taught how to wield box cutters.
Right. I know, that was too big of an attack for just a couple guys by themselves.
It was coordinated, and it was embedded inside a war game where the conspirators were able to use these virtual private networks and encryption systems, right, to practice and develop the maneuvers unbeknown to the blue team defenders and the legitimate red team attackers who had been having these war games twice a year since 1947.
So you think that even though America was claiming that Iraq was under embargo and sealed off, Saddam was still somehow involved in planning and coordinating the 9/11 attack, even though...
Oh, yes. I mean, the United Nations recognized that UNSCOM, the United Nations Security Commission that was trying to check on Saddam's continuation of his weapons of mass destruction through to 1998, Saddam threw them out. And the next time there was any kind of visit from the United Nations was with this group, the UNMOVIC team. Well, Eric, they were on Saddam's payroll.
Right. Well,
they're just a joke, right? They were paid by Saddam to go in and inspect that he hadn't got these weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, you've got these virtual private networks that are helping Saddam conceal and hide and move his weapons. And there are satellite images, which are now very conveniently lost, showing convoys of trucks heading towards the Syrian border, taking these materials across the border into Syria as the Brits and the Americans were going in a different direction.
So you think those reports are true, that he just moved them all over to Syria?
Yeah, of course.
So they're over there now, as far as you know. You would.
Well, no, I think they're actually in Canada now, and they've crossed into the United States, because I have access to a controlled goods certificate issued by the Ministry of Public Works of Canada during the period when the minister of the Ministry of Public Works was Alfonso Gagliano, who allegedly is a made member of the Bonanno crime family.
That's
right? So the Ministry of Public Works in Canada was smuggling drugs, and therefore it would find it very, very easy to smuggle weapons of mass destruction that had been moved out of Iraq in order to conceal Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program, which we know he'd been working on before the Americans and the Brits went in. He'd never stopped. He was using precursor materials, but he had a very efficient intelligence apparatus, and he had some very powerful friends inside the United States and Canada to move the material through Syria into Canada, I think using Canada steamship lines, and backloading the pipeline that used to be in place for Lafarge to move incendiary cluster bombs into Iraq. I think they were backloaded, these large tankers and self-unloading vessels, with his weapons of mass destruction, which are now distributed strategically around the United States of America.
Well, if the Carlyle Group
comes through this. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if the Carlyle Group is planning all this, why would they even need his assistance with 9/11? What would he offer? What could he, in this, it's not as advanced as America or Canada or Europe. What would he even be able to offer?
What are you saying? He's not as advanced. You're saying that the Iraqis are not advanced?
Well, not compared to, I mean, America. What would anyone turn to him for help? What would anyone get out of him?
It's classically you need a double false flag situation. First of all, America is not ready for a, you know what the phrase coup d'etat, overthrow of the government?
Right.
All right. But the forces that are inside America, particularly these hard left anarcho-syndicalists, which is what Chomsky wants, which is a revolution where the government and industry is controlled by one big labor union, America is not quite ready for it. It's actually heading that way. So you need an external enemy. Right? But equally, you don't want the entire forces of America to take out that enemy, which would be Iraq. So you create, I believe, what they did, the CIA, John Deutsch, and the insiders in America and Canada, they created a false flag organization called Al-Qaeda, built from the database stolen by John Deutsch. But Al-Qaeda never has been able to put on a sophisticated attack because it doesn't have access to state research laboratories, etc. So the idea is using the eavesdropping techniques that Al Gore had stolen was to listen into conspiracies as they're developing in the United States. For example, the alleged Al-Qaeda conspiracy to attack the buildings of 1, 2, and 7, and then infiltrate expert terrorists inside that group. And the expert terrorists fled back to Iraq just before or just after the attack on the first World Trade Center. And the guys who went to jail were people like the blind sheikh. Well, by definition, a blind sheikh is not going to be very good at building a bomb and putting it in, in 1993. So all the patsies, you know, the Al-Qaeda, the Muslim extremists, etc., they were set up when really it was an expert terrorist operation run by the Iraqi intelligence services in a partnership, I allege, with socialists and revolutionary socialists and radicals in Canada and Quebec and inside the United States around the Al Gore and Clinton White House.
So they were using the Iraqi intelligence services as for assistance or just as personnel to do some of the dirty, the low
level? No, the training. A place called Salman Pak was the training ground in Iraq for jihadists and mujahideen, and the aerial photographs show that they had the fuselage of a Boeing, where many reports indicate that they were training Al-Qaeda-type hijackers for the relatively low-level unarmed combat job of taking over a plane. What they couldn't do, and it's quite obvious, that if you can persuade someone to commit suicide and go and collect 72 virgins, you know, they're going to have a very short span of attention for learning how to fly a plane safely, right?
Right.
And why would you bother, if you're going to earn $120,000 or $180,000 flying a big Boeing, why commit suicide and take the off chance there aren't 72 virgins waiting for you?
Right.
Right, there's basically a paradox there. So the paradox is that Al-Qaeda traditionally has never been able to get sophisticated suiciders.
Well,
okay, so they need help. So what Al-Qaeda is able to do, however, is teach people to disengage their brain by praying for 19 hours a day with their knees on the prayer mat, and offering the family $15,000, or I think Saddam was offering $25,000 to the families of the suicide people who were ready to die, using money stolen from the Oil for Food program, and use those kind of people to conceal a strategic attack. So, for example, the strategic objectives of 9-1-1 were knock over the World Trade Center building, destroy the world's biggest carbon dioxide credit trading facility at the top of the North Tower, Cantor Fitzgerald, destroy the files on the Wall Street frauds at floors 11, 12, and 13 in building number 7, and to eliminate the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon, and therefore break the chain of command between the President of the United States and U.S. naval assets around the world. So they were very ambitious strategic targets, and knock out the New York Stock Exchange. And in order to do that, they had to infiltrate inside regular government departments, Department of State, Department of Justice, Department of Interior, Office of Construction Management, the Pentagon. And they did that by infiltrating AMEC with huge upfront payments or loans for the contracts. And behind AMEC, I allege, were the militant saboteurs of the mobbed-up laborers' union. And on the morning of 9/11, let me just tell you some of the skill sets of the laborers' union, which is 800,000 strong. And remember, they were going to go into a racketeering influence, corrupt organization trusteeship. And by bribing the election campaign managers of Bill Clinton, something like $3 million, they were able to get that Department of Justice draft complaint dropped. So on the morning of 9/11, what Clinton and the laborers' president, Arthur Coyer, had managed to do was to get the air traffic controllers of the Federal Aviation Administration admitted as members of Local 2097 of the laborers' union in Oklahoma City. They were also into waste management, air traffic control, construction, and something else very interesting, anthrax remediation. You remember what happened after 9/11?
Oh, yeah, the anthrax, mysterious anthrax.
Yeah, coming through the mail handling. You know who represents the mail handlers of North America? The laborers' union.
Oh. Laborers, yeah, that's right.
And you train the mail handlers in one of the training schools that the draft RICO complaint alleges is that training funds were being stolen by the bosses of the laborers' union and used for training that wasn't in the interest of the members. And I believe they were being trained in the sabotage techniques used on 9-1-1. Anyway, let me keep going. The laborers also specialize in demolition, aircraft mechanics, and debris removal, and mail handling. I think of the acronym WACADEM. So the laborers, and within the laborers, I'm sure there's hundreds of thousands, as 800,000 strong, of good, loyal Americans, but you only need, let's say, 1,000 saboteurs to infiltrate the laborers' union, get inside these virtual private networks, and you have one guy who can, for example, learn how to fly a plane through this instrument approach procedure software from McDonnell Detweiler.
I see.
And so you jam the signal from the United States Air Force Base, you take over the plane, you fly it into the U.S. Naval Command Center, and you knock over a strategic target for your hated enemy, which is the wealthiest and most powerful, and I believe one of the most liberal and most generous-hearted nations on the face of the earth, and I'm not even an American.
Right. You also
I'm absolutely appalled at the way Americans have been persuaded to think badly of themselves.
Well, Noam Chomsky helps with that.
Of course he does, and so Noam Chomsky will be a defendant in our lawsuit.
Yeah, you also mentioned this Swiss bank I never heard of before. You said they were in
UBS.
Yeah, well, who are they, and what is their role? Financing or what?
UBS is the world's largest private investment bank. So if you're extremely rich or extremely crooked, it would appear, you go to Switzerland, and let's say you've got $1 billion of money that you've creamed off the UN Oil for Food program through kickbacks to this useless, dysfunctional organization, but you've got a problem of money laundering, $1 billion. So you give it to UBS, for example, and say, can you take care of it and find some technique where this $1 billion can be laundered so it's got a legitimate explanation when the police come knocking in Switzerland? And what UBS developed with this world's largest insurance company is, and it's 50 years old, it might date back to the Holocaust or even back to the Armenian Catholic massacre under the Ottoman Turks in 1916 and 17. What AXA has done, and a number of directors have gone to jail for this, they've developed a system for money laundering through what are known as dead peasant life insurance contracts.
Oh.
So you take your $1 billion, right, and you put it in the account which is contains the dirty money. All right, and then you come through what is called AXA Re, which is a reinsurance arm of AXA. So AXA, let's say, will sell life insurance to the firefighters in New York to the pension fund. So when and if one or two firefighters die, then the pension fund would come to AXA and claim the money that would allow the pension fund, the New York Firefighters Pension Fund, to pay the pension of the victim to the widow or the spouse,
right,
according to a certain period. But to execute that contract, that life insurance contract where AXA is selling insurance, the victim's spouse has to come to the payment center that was opened by AXA on the 17th of September 2001 in downtown Manhattan and present the death certificate. You get it?
Yeah.
So the death certificate...
Oh, well,
the death certificate is, sorry.
Oh, I was just saying, so this bank is, their role is more money laundering, not so much planning or anything with 9/11. They're more of a money laundering group?
Yeah, they're looking for investment opportunities that are put up to them by so-called private equity groups, such as Carlyle Canada. So Carlyle Canada would go to a group of investors and say, have we got a deal for you? Right? We can arrange for you to be invested short in Chicago. And a panic on the New York Stock Exchange, where if you know on the 10th of September there's going to be a panic on the New York Stock Exchange and there's going to be a $1.2 trillion loss on the capital markets, then what you do is you sell forward.
Right.
You sell the shares for future delivery, knowing that when it comes to delivery time, the shares would have collapsed so you can buy them in for next to nothing.
So this bank is really, they're just profiting from the 9/11 and other other crimes. They're not really participating. They're just profiting from it.
And here it comes back to the beauty of RICO, Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization. All you need to do is to say that senior people in the bank were part of an organization providing what is known as unlawful debt to a borrower in order to extort interest, income, or influence over that borrower. So by destroying, for example, Nortel or Enron or Dynergy or Quest or Worcom or Tyco, right, through hedge fund frauds on those companies, what they did is they trapped the directors into borrowing money off book, probably dirty money, and then extorted the directors into crashing their own companies.
Oh, so you think they're actually involved in doing some of these crimes then?
Well, we are joining them. We will be joining them in our list of 100 members of an alleged racketeering influence and corrupt organization that we allege has been operating a murder-for-hire network in violation of U.S. Code, I think it's 1895, I can't quite remember, for some 35 years since the RICO statute was introduced in October 1970. So the RICO remedy is treble damages. During that process, we will have, the plaintiffs will have the right of discovery. All right? When we have discovery, it may be that some of these people, and they will be watched, I believe, by the entire American public, if not the entire world, they will, ultimately, the public will determine whether a threshold has been passed, whether we've got enough evidence not only to win the case for treble damages under RICO, but whether enough evidence has been produced to stand a reasonable chance in the court of getting a conviction for murder one, where the jury will require enough evidence to make that decision beyond reasonable doubt.
Now, is this bank involved with other banks, or are they more isolated?
Yes, they are. No, they're not. None of these banks are isolated. In fact, they're all joined together, and that's what the preamble to the lawsuit mentions, in an organization called the United Nations Environmental Program, which has now got 160 signatories, including the largest banks in the world, J.P. Morgan and AXA and UBS. And the United Nations Environmental Program is really about what I describe as kleptofascism in the global commons. What they're really saying to every citizen is, you don't really have the right to exist unless you're paying a rent for occupying space in the global commons, and we deem you to be breathing out too much carbon dioxide. So
yeah.
Therefore, we want you to pay us $50 a ton next year. Well, we want you to pay now, but then we'll give you an IOU, which is says to the individual citizen, we're going to allow you to breathe out next year.
I know, that'd be a big tax scam, that's what that is.
But it's the greatest scam ever, particularly the guy who's doing the trading is Al Gore and David Blood.
Well, yeah, I know, it's a worldwide tax, they would collect a worldwide tax.
You know what, Eric, it's the tax, the tax is, you pay for the right to exist.
I know, and you have no idea where your money's going or who's getting it.
It's going into their back pockets.
Does this bank you're referring to, does this have to do with the insurance companies that are and the like the Rothschild banks, the Federal Reserve, and this whole network? Is it like one big network?
Yes. Because in that United Nations Environmental Program, so our the short name we've given, because there's a whole group of partners and affiliates to this scam that starts with Arkansas in Arkansas in the 1970s with the tainted blood, and runs through to what I called Kyoto 911. The United Nations Environmental Program was started in 1972 by Maurice Strong, the guy who's director of the Cargo Climate Exchange. So this was the period where, if you look at the draft RICO complaint by the Department of Justice against the Laborers International Union of North America, they say the racketeering organizations and activities go back to the 60s, if not beyond, but the RICO statute was not introduced until October 1970. So in October 1970, the Department of Justice recognized the Laborers Union with its 800,000 members as a mobbed-up union. And in 1972, Maurice Strong launched the United Nations Environmental Program, which says that every bank and every organization and every company is really only allowed to exist in the global commons on the sufferance of the trustees, the self-appointed trustees of the United Nations. And in order to continue to exist, they should extort or extract a tax or a tithe from the citizen, which is, by any definition, racketeering. So what we've said is that we've joined the Laborers International Union of North America, and the acronym for that is LUNA, with the signatories to the United Nations Environmental Program, plus all their parasitical law firms and accounting firms like Rose Law Firm and so on, and said that is our alleged racketeering influence and corrupt organization, and it's LUNA hyphen UNEP, and UNEP stands for the United Nations Environmental Program. So what we can do, or what we'll try to do with the 100 plaintiffs, is prove that that is operating a murder for hire, a global murder for hire network using virtual private networks and encryption to conceal its activities from regular folks, and we will endeavor to prove that whether or not the individual members had what is called in Latin mens rea, the guilty mind. You see, I think what they really consider the dead on 911 as collateral damage, a necessary condition in order to take custody of the right to trade in carbon dioxide in the global commons.
Oh, yeah.
By knocking down the North Tower.
Yeah, that's right, collateral damage. You know, the other thing, people down here, we don't know a lot about Canada, but we hear there's accusations that the Bronfman family is a big controller of government over there. And are they involved in your lawsuit, the Bronfmans?
No, it's primarily it's targeted at the board of directors of Boeing, on the basis of proximity, since it was Boeing weapons used on 911, and they were Boeing weapons that could not have been flown in the manner they were flown by the people inside the cockpit, given the limited flying skills of those people. So Boeing, we know, provided a component of the weaponry used on 911, and we know that Boeing at the time was controlled by what is called off-book debt by the Carlyle Canada and its affiliated private equity group, CAI. And I know the names of 28 of the 50 prominent individuals of the CAI private equity group. It includes General Alexander Haig, who was the I'm in charge here when Ronald Reagan was shot, and he made a grab for the suitcase containing the codes for the atomic weapons. And Alexander Haig was a NATO Supreme Allied Commander in the 90s or early 90s. And he was also the first guy in the Tiananmen Square after the massacre of any note from America, representing America for the 50th anniversary of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. So you've got some pretty weird characters in that 50 members of the CAI private equity group, and they will be defendants, except that I only know the names of 28. What I'm really interested through a program like yours is to find out who are the other 22, and I've been asking the various outfits for pension funds that use these private equity services, and they're refusing to tell me.
Oh, I see. So you're still looking for some names of people involved then?
Yes. I know there's 22 people, and I believe those 22 include some household names. But in court, you see, we will have discovery, and we can force them to produce the names.
And what about...
I'd like to ask... Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to ask, are the Chinese involved in any way? Li Ka-shing, are they any of your defendants that...
Yes, they are absolutely involved, but the point is, realistically, when we get into court, we've got to get people who can realistically be brought into court. So it's extremely unlikely I'm going to be able to get the chief guy in the People's Liberation Army of China into a court in Fargo in North Dakota, even though I would like that. So we really need to have the people who are dealing with the Chinese during the period of these frauds and treasonous activities. So what's quite intriguing, for example, is the guy who probably had the most knowledge about how to sabotage a war game on 9/11 so that you'd start where the blue team assumed that it knew what it was going to do, and the red team, which is the attack team, knew what it was going to do, and then at some point suddenly switch through jamming an electronic warfare so the red team could go to a real attack. The one guy possibly in the world with the deepest and most profound knowledge of how that could be done is a guy called John Shalikashvili, who was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Clinton until 1997. And in 1997, he went, sent by Clinton, to the People's Liberation Army University in Beijing. And in his closing address, this is the chairman of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said to the People's Liberation Army representatives at the university in Beijing, and until a few months ago I didn't know that they even had one there, but anyway, he said, "Before I leave here, I will provide you with details of all America's weapons programs." think about that.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Clinton and Shalikashvili handed over the details of all Americans' weapons programs, including, I believe, the notion of the missile, the triaxial missile gyroscope embedded in Boeing passenger aircraft that could be used by forces hostile to America to switch from a commercial flight, where everyone thinks that this is just about carrying passengers from A to B, from Buffalo to New York or whatever, and suddenly and simultaneously switch a significant number of planes into guided missiles. Now, on the morning of the 1st and 2nd of June 2001, there was a major war game going on in the United States called Amalgam Virgo, and the script for that war game was a plane hijacked over Alaska, overflying British Columbia and Abbotsford Airport that I mentioned earlier, going south and turning east and simulating an attack on the Capitol building in the United States, using, I suggest, the technology that we've just described, the remote flying technology. Now, there was another war game going on the 1st and 2nd of June 2001, many, many miles away, put on by the People's Liberation Army of China, staging a paratrooper and multi-trifibious attack on the island of Taiwan, using, I believe, the same technology as was used allegedly by Al-Qaeda on 911 to fly the planes, because China had received 120 planes, 737s and modified flight boxes, from Boeing illegally, for which Boeing, amongst others, paid the $615 million fine. So Boeing and John Shalikashvili had equipped the Chinese People's Liberation Army with dual-use passenger aircraft that could be switched to missiles. So I think if Flight 93 had left on time and hit Washington, D.C. on time, it would have hit the Capitol building, killed hundreds of congressmen and senators, and in the confusion, remember, the U.S. president was now out of contact with the U.S. naval assets because the U.S. Naval Command Center had been destroyed. I believe China would have been invaded Taiwan using the same techniques of modified passenger aircraft. And folks, that would have been the end of your republic and the end of freedom.
Yeah, well, you know, what I mentioned once before is that nobody ever brings out Clinton's crime connections for ever since he's been around. And are you going to add some of the media executives to your lawsuit for helping to cover it up and for accessories to crime? Because they're stopping it. They won't let...
Oh, yes, yes. Well, if you look at some of the directors of Boeing, and I can't give you all the names there, there's a number, such as, for example, senior executives in Walt Disney, right?
CBS, NBC, the Hollywood...
Oh, yeah, yeah. You see, and that would come under the category of spoliation of evidence or spinning or obstruction of justice. The problem is, this. What I'm wrestling with is to try and keep this lawsuit manageable. Already 100 plaintiffs and 100 defendants is pretty huge, and it could go up to 10,000, but we don't want to get paralyzed because it's so broad. If we can prove wrongful death, and then a securities fraud of the order of $1.2 trillion, get a triple damage suit, start getting these people hauled into court, there's no reason why that should be the last civil claim, because I believe when people see these people coming into court and we get discovery, there's going to be a huge number of civil lawsuits triggered right across North America by families, you know, with an order. I'm trying to develop with my colleague Field McConnell a generic umbrella manageable thing with a very clear definition of what violations of U.S. code have been being alleged, and in particular, and it's fairly narrow, the operation of a murder for hire network. And if you Google for murder for hire in U.S. code, you'll find that is part of the RICO predicate calculus, if you will. If someone commits this, this, and this, i.e. travels or uses, including the victim, or inducing the victim, to use interstate commerce for the purposes of murder for hire in return for pecuniary compensation, you know, that's a very precise definition. I think we can prove it. Then you've got a case under a civil RICO claim for wrongful death.
Right. Well, if your case were to actually go to trial and do something, you'd be taking out a lot of people here.
Oh, yeah.
But we'd
be basically taking out the core group, you know, provided the jury. Now, let me back up here. Going back to King Ethelred the Unready, an English king in the 10th century, interesting enough, he's credited with the launching or creating the first concept of the grand jury, and maybe I mentioned that in the previous interview, but in Old English, presumably, what he said is, accuse no innocent and shelter no guilty. What the media and these manipulators of public opinion who control these virtual private networks, they've created a brilliant method of camouflaging the guilty, to the point you don't, you know, we're looking all over the world when it's actually right here. So I think the forensic economists at the Horse Cafe, and that is anyone who joins that Yahoo group, becomes one. What we have to be very careful with is there are no crimes by association. I'm not accusing anyone of murdering anyone. We know that they were murdered on 911, but we don't have enough evidence to get a conviction in a court for beyond reasonable doubt, so we have to back up, and we have to start rolling up it's a long-winded expression, the counterintelligence networks that were put in place during the Clinton and Gore administration, where they dismantled America's and Canada's ability to protect ourselves. So Horse Cafe is about, if you will, a citizen's counterintelligence agency. It's just ordinary citizens keeping their eyes open and their ears pinned back and looking for human intelligence that would tell us how these people, how the guilty are being sheltered, and remove their cover. And one of the goals of this court case, this lawsuit in Fargo in North Dakota, is to eliminate shelter for the guilty.
Right. Well, you see, that brings up a very interesting concept, because if your lawsuit were to go through and you get like some of these executives at Boeing, the Carlyle Group, some of the banking families, I can't remember all the people you said, even Iraq. Think about this for a minute. Imagine all of them being arrested. That takes out any.
No, hang on. In a civil case, you're not arresting people. What they have to prove is that they weren't responsible for the wrongful death of a fellow citizen, either through, this is very broad, negligence, recklessness, willfulness, or fraud. So I was a safety officer in the oil industry, and if we had a case in an engineer in Indonesia, and he didn't follow the safety procedures correctly, he had explosives on the catwalk of an oil rig, and the explosives were detonated and killed an Indonesian helper. And this guy, he didn't intend to kill the guy. In fact, I imagine if in his shoes, he was absolutely horrified and heartbroken. But he was arrested and put in a jail. All right? Basically, he wasn't accused of murder. He was accused of negligence, which
right.
can go up to negligent homicide or whatever. So I don't want, in the first pass, these people arrested. I want them brought into court and a jury to determine, are they responsible for the wrongful death of a fellow citizen, including Canadian citizens and British citizens who died in 911?
Right, but once, if you could ever get to that point where they're in court, I mean, there is an awful lot of evidence against them, and it would.
Well, sure, and I believe what will inevitably happen with some of these people is, and again, can you imagine a bigger media event?
Well, right, but see, this leads us to this one interesting possibility. Imagine if the public then, that would kind of open it up to the public. They'd get involved. It'd be anger everywhere.
Right.
There very likely would be arrests. And then imagine what that would mean if that was taken out, if that group was taken out. Who's left? I mean, see, this is when you have to wonder, what if the Israelis are involved? That means they just got rid of all of their competition. They are the only ones remaining.
Well, Eric, with all due respect, you seem to be obsessed with believing that the Israelis are behind it. I don't believe that to be true.
I'm saying all they have to be is a small role, and then, like you said, disguise the guilty. They all send you over to the Carlyle Group, you arrest them, and then they're the only ones left. They have.
Well, then no one's sending me anywhere.
No, but see, it would be a subtle thing if they did it.
But you're hypothesizing.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying if I was an Israeli, what I would be doing is telling everybody, oh, look at the Carlyle Group, look at George Bush, look at this person, that person. It's not Israel. Look at Iraq, and then fool everybody into arresting everybody I didn't like. And then I'd be left alone. I'd have total control of the banks, the insurance companies, the media, the governments. It would be a great plan if they were that smart and clever, you see. I'm just saying we ought to consider it.
Well, no, you can consider it. I'm just beavering away, and you'd be welcome to point that out as a danger or a risk, but ultimately you've got to prove it.
No, I know you have to, but it's with any crime. Whenever you have a big crime, everybody in the crime network is going to be trying to get themselves off and put the blame on someone else.
What we have that's very interesting is the number three at the Department of Justice. And we're having a little trouble in determining when she was actually there. Is a woman by the name of Christine Marcy, who is the sister of Field McConnell. So what we're saying to these people, and it's not a threatening thing, I think when this trial comes down, well, I'm not sure trial is the right word, the hearing, because it's a civil claim for damages, there'll be a jury, and the jury will hear the case. And I would argue, and I think I mentioned that Ninth Amendment logic at the last interview, but I believe every citizen in the world, not just the United States, but let's keep it in the United States because of your Constitution, which is an extraordinary document. The Ninth Amendment says any rights enumerated, spelt out in the American Constitution, are not intended to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. And I believe every citizen of America, and by extension in the common law countries around the world, and ultimately the world itself, has the right to collect evidence against people suspected of causing the wrongful death of a fellow citizen. And the beauty of living under the law, no matter how corrupt you think the courts have become, the principle is always the same. Accuse no innocent, but shelter no guilty. That's the beauty of the jury. And there are jurisdictions, for example, under the French Napoleonic Code, where you're guilty until you're proved innocent. All right? And I'm sure you don't want to live under that.
Right.
So when we get into court in front of a jury, these people will have the opportunity to prove that they did not cause the wrongful death of a fellow citizen. Now, why is that so important? It's very important that I, even though I'm not an American, and I know some Canadians and some British people were killed in 9/11, that I, as a citizen of the world, with whatever God has given me by way of gift, attend to the wrongful death of a fellow citizen. Right? And I don't believe the people who jumped out of the windows in the North Tower, hand in hand, and turned over and over before dying on the ground, I don't think the American people have woken up to the fact that they not only have an interest, in my belief, they have an absolute duty to investigate those deaths, no matter how difficult it's been made for them. Because the flip side of it is, if I won't investigate the wrongful death of a fellow citizen, why would I expect them to investigate the wrongful death of me?
Right.
So I don't think we've done our work as citizens, either of the United States or Canada and the UK. And again, it's not about accusing people that we don't like politically or racially or ethnically. It's about collecting evidence against people suspected. Now, I believe we have motive, we have opportunity, and most importantly, we have weapon. And we can trace the development of those weapons right back to the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, Arkansas in the 70s. The first weapon, I allege, being tainted blood, which was injected, for example, in the veins of vets coming back from Vietnam. By simply monitoring who got that tainted blood, a life insurance policy could buy life insurance in those victims and make huge amounts of money because they were going to die earlier rather than later. And I believe we can demonstrate that the Rose Law Firm partners, in particular Vincent Foster, who died in 1993, was the Rose Law Firm's partner appointed to broker the tainted blood scam from the Arkansas correction system by Bill Clinton, the governor, and Hillary Clinton, Vince Foster's partner at the Rose Law Firm.
Yeah, if we could get people to investigate.
Well, I'm getting a huge amount of support from a number of vets who are dying as we speak because they've been injected and they've got hepatitis C and AIDS, and they feel that this came about as a result of when they returned from Vietnam, they were injected with tainted blood, but there's been no remedy.
Right.
Plus, well, I would argue that then we have maybe 10 to 30 to 40,000 wrongful deaths, remember, not accusing them of murder,
right,
but either negligence, recklessness, willfulness, or fraud that resulted in the death of a fellow citizen, for which they must pay up to triple damages, right, to the victim's families.
Well, plus they said they're using uranium in Iraq, and that's getting into the soldiers' bodies and causing retarded babies and cancers. And
yeah, but you know, again, we have, I would argue, almost a cast iron case. There are families that have already launched a class action suit against the tainted blood. It was laundered through a company called Connaught in Toronto or Montreal, controlled through, I think, the Canada Development Corporation, where the director was Paul Martin, controlled by Carlisle Canada.
Well, let's hope we can get.
So we've got a whole bunch of guys, right, who are principals, I would allege, in a murder for hire network, wittingly or unwittingly. That network is being used to bump people off for the purposes of insurance fraud.
Right.
I had a question. In the discovery stage, will you be able then to ask who made the kickbacks, or I guess you would say the profit from the short selling of United Airlines and American Airlines? Can you ask for that in court?
Absolutely, of course, because the people that we'll be asking will be include the hedge fund managers who took out the short positions on 911.
Well, plus it would be interesting to find out who's blocking the investigations, because Europe, Japan, and America have not been able to investigate. Even after they said, they announced they would investigate, somebody stopped all of them.
Yeah, now, coming back to these virtual private networks, in 1993 on, thanks to Al Gore, who promoted this, I think they called it the information infrastructure grid or something, where he claims frivolously to have invented the internet. In actual fact, I believe what Al Gore did is he corrupted the internet, and he developed an internal surveillance system that was able to eavesdrop and listen and monitor people's emails and other kinds of communications whilst buying up a virtual private network that allowed the conspirators to develop their conspiracy safe from any monitoring.
Yeah, you mean the people that he works for, because he himself sure didn't do anything. He seems like a bit of a psychotic to me. I mean,
again, it's important not to let personal opinions. You see, the guy will have his day in court, right? And he's going to have to. He's going to be facing an allegation that he was instrumental as part of a larger organization,
right,
a racketeering organization, in causing the wrongful death of his fellow human beings.
Right, right. As part of an organization, I know you're using it as a generic term, but people do that with Bush. They're always saying like Bush did this, Bush did that. Bush is kind of like a puppet. But you're treating Al Gore the same way, right? You're not actually. He's just part of a group when you say Al Gore did this.
Yeah, I'm saying he's a member, insider, or affiliated with a group that I've put it, or we put an acronym together, which is LUNA UNIP, the Laborers International Union of North America, and the United Nations Environmental Program, because LUNA and UNIP, as an entity, are involved in international drug smuggling and drug trafficking, and we know that Al Gore used the confiscated proceeds of drug busts at the Department of Justice to buy in this virtual private network and then deploy it. And all these guys have wonderful Orwellian phrases, but this one is really spooky. What Al Gore launched in 1993, the full name is the Interagency Working Group for Environmental Justice. Now, I wonder what the difference between environmental justice and regular justice is. Well, I think I know. Environmental justice allows these people to kill you if you breathe out too much carbon dioxide.
Right.
Right? Because what they're really saying is our first duty is to the survival survival of the earth, which we think will not survive if white Anglo-Saxon Protestants are allowed to produce too much carbon dioxide.
Yeah, see, there's a group behind him. That group would be interesting. Who are they, and who are the scientists supporting it?
Well, that's it. And I think we've got a significant number in the 100 that we've presently named. But what I'm saying to my colleagues, and we're at draft 22, and I don't know whether we may publish at draft 50, or maybe 29 or 30 in a few days' time. But essentially what we're saying to the internal group at Hortz Cafe is what we need of the people on the defendants list is not that because they're guilty by association, etc., etc. We need them to have in a legal concept what's called proximity. And what I'm now very interested in, who are the people who developed the three key virtual private networks for 911? Now, let me go back a bit. Osama bin Laden, and I think I mentioned that in the first interview, he said, or he was quoted as saying in the Time magazine, we have three independent networks to move Al-Qaeda assets around the world, and all the resources of the British and the Americans cannot stop us. And at various times I thought that was a human intelligence, financial intelligence, electronic intelligence network. Then I thought it was AMEC, the land company, Boeing, the air company, and Canada Steamship Lines, the shipping company for trifibious attacks of 911. And then I stumbled across this fact that Al Gore had used drug money from the Department of Justice slush fund to buy in this equipment for the virtual private network built with AT&T's secure telephony systems. And I think now I'm leaning towards the idea that the three networks about which Osama bin Laden boasted are three virtual private networks that are actually buried inside the American and the Canadian governments and industry and military. And the three networks would be AT&T's secure telephony system, Nortel's voice internet protocol, which was in the Pentagon, and Boeing's Iridium and Thuraya satellite communications, which we know were used by Al-Qaeda. And that would give them the ability during a war game to flip to the total surprise of the regular red team attackers and the regular blue team defenders from a simulated attack to a real one. And then a huge problem for the regular people who are patriotic Americans is their voices would have been recorded right through to the point where the red team was attacking merely by deleting the command from the red team commander, knock it off, which means the exercise over. It would look to a jury subsequently that the red team had proceeded all the way with an attack on America and the killing of the citizens. So they've got a wonderful blackmail opportunity to record the red team simulating an attack and deleting information that would have indicated the red team was double-crossed, if you see my point.
Right. Well, yeah, the double-crossing is what's extreme, probably, in this situation.
Yes, I think there was a double-cross. So what we need to do is winnow down the 100 defendants from a list of all the people we would like to convict because we don't like them politically or whatever, to the 100 people that are closest to those three networks. Now, Osama bin Laden made one other threat, or it's an implied comment. He said, it matters not whether Muslims or socialists destroy America. So what I believe from that is that he's embedded three networks, not Osama bin Laden, but Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda never had very much in the way of assets, right? But what they did have, it would appear, is they moved them on someone else's networks. And I suggest to you and the listeners that those networks are the three virtual private networks that Al Gore and the Clinton White House extorted from government and industry using, amongst others, drug money and money stolen from the UN Orphan Food Program. And what they've done is they've equipped the United Nations with what's known technically as a C4ISR system, Command Control Communications Computers Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance, embedded through virtual private networks inside the American, Canadian, British, and Australian military.
So you're saying Osama actually did play some role with 9/11 then? He really...
Oh, yeah. He's a mercenary. Maurice Strong said in 1990, or is quoted, he was interviewed by a magazine in Canada called Western Star, and he was interviewed at a World Economic Conference in Davos. And about a book or a piece of fiction that he was allegedly going to write, and again, this is from memory, so excuse me if I don't get it 100%. What Maurice Strong said is, the greatest threat to the survival of the planet are the rich industrialized countries. And what would happen if we issued a command for them to deindustrialize and they disobeyed? Well, our first duty is to save the planet. So the way we would, and we would have to destroy the rich industrialized countries, and the way we would do that is we'd take a position in the international markets, commodity, gold, stock market, etc., etc., and computers and gold, hire mercenaries, right, and create a panic and jam open the stock markets. So what I read from that is, and this is a man who, because he is the godfather of the Kyoto scam and the oil for food scam, he's in a position to do exactly what he described in this theoretically fictional story he was going to write. If you look at 9/11, what he did was he hired mercenaries, this is my allegation, from the Al-Qaeda team, that is these jihadists and the people, simple-minded, who want to go and collect the virgins and they're ready to commit suicide. So they're a bit of brainwashing and so on, they can be persuaded to do that. Putting them in planes that had been previously modified, so whilst it would look like Al-Qaeda was in charge of the operation, really, it was the socialists and militants a la Chomsky, through MIT and Paul Gray and so on, who had access to the flight boxes, and they could convert a simulated Al-Qaeda hijacking where novice pilots would sit inside the cockpit and crash the plane somewhere and actually fly the planes very accurately at a strategic target like the U.S. Naval Command Center.
Yeah, well, that would make sense.
But if you look at 9/11, was they hired mercenaries, which are these Al-Qaeda guys, and there was a rich pool of that because John Deutsch had stolen the database, so there were plenty of people who used to be employed by the CIA to kick the Soviets out who were no longer employed by the CIA but who could be given another job, which was not necessarily fully understanding what they were doing because they were only shown a small piece of the conspiracy. They might have thought they were just testing out this technology.
Well, right, they were like the patsies. The Arabs were just set up.
Yeah.
They were just used, just like
yeah.
McVeigh and all the others seemed to be.
Yeah, yeah. And the intriguing thing is...
I had a question. Regarding the time that the Al-Qaeda was named the mass media worldwide, interesting that our Attorney General in Ontario told two of the most wanted in the Al-Qaeda team to leave Ontario. This came out. I don't know if you knew about this as well. So that shows there's some form of complicity in the fact of our government members probably being part and parcel of knowledge of these Al-Qaeda teams.
Oh, absolutely. And like I say, I believe Canada, more specifically Quebec, and most specifically Gatineau, Quebec, on the north side of the Ottawa River, obviously out of reach of the RICO statute in the States. And Canada has become the home for a lot of disaffected Muslims from Morocco and Algeria. I believe Ahmed Razam was Moroccan or Algerian, perhaps, who was going to do the Y2K hit on the Los Angeles airport. But French-speaking Canada in Quebec is the home for the extremely militant kinds of movements, such as the Ba'ath Party Socialists. And the Ba'ath Party is a radical socialist party that was started by two French-trained teachers in 1947. And the spiritual home for these people, it's French syndicalism, and syndicalism, it's a French word meaning an international labor group that believes in the use of terror and sabotage and strikes to take control of government and industry. I believe the home of syndicalism in North America is in Quebec, in Montreal, and in Gatineau, Quebec. And the Parti Québécois, they used to call it, when it had some influence, it's lost a little bit of influence, or at least apparently it's lost influence, they called it the Republic of Teachers. Now, because of the many members of the Parti Québécois, the provincial government, who were teaching at university. Now, David Rockefeller said, again, this is a quote from memory, he said, the world is ready to move towards a supranational government of world bankers and an intellectual elite. Considerably better than... Yeah, David Rockefeller, this, you know, the head cheese at Chase Manhattan and now J.P. Morgan. Well, it was J.P. Morgan that forced to effectively the Iridium satellite operator Motorola into bankruptcy by suing the directors for alleged misrepresentation of income. So an investment by the Motorola shareholders of $5 billion went through Chapter 11 and the liquidate and came out the other side. And for a mere $25 million, this military satellite communication system used by the Department of Justice and the Pentagon for pole-to-pole communication 24 hours a day, 7 hours a week, independent of the land system, was bought by a private equity group for $25 million, Eric. And in that private equity group, one of the principal shareholders was a Saudi Arabian sheikh handling money for the Bin Laden family.
Yeah. Well, there's Rockefeller. They're the ones that built the towers in the first place in 19...
Correct. Correct.
Now, do you see them as just working for the Rothschilds? Supposedly, the Rothschilds funded them, and they actually are friends or work with them. Is that true from you? What you see?
No, what I see is these are principal members of the racketeering, influence, and corrupt organization that I label with the acronym LUNA UNIT, Laborers International Union of North America, which are the spear carriers and the spear throwers. These are the special weapons and tactics teams, you know, that are used. I mean, LUNA demolishes buildings with explosives.
Right. Well, I just meant the Rockefellers themselves. You see, they're in this crime network, but do you see them as working for?
No. I mean, remember, we have yet to go to court,
right,
and prove that they are members of this network. When we go to court, what we're saying is there is a criminal network operating a murder for hire network, and we have evidence to put in front of a jury that demonstrates or proves these people are either insiders, members, or affiliates or associates of a racketeering organization.
Well, I meant in evidence. I don't mean
we haven't yet proven that is the case.
I don't mean that you proved it. I mean, I just was saying, how do you see the Rockefellers? Because people like Alex Jones are putting them at the, you know, way at the top here. Then there's others saying that they're just actually they're funded.
No, I think the Rockefellers are, you know, way at the top. At the top of the Carlyle Group, you have particularly this group of which I know the names of 28. Of what they declare are 50 prominent individuals. I'm trying to find the identity of the remaining 22, but I believe instinctively from evidence that David Rockefeller is one of them.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because see, some people think a lot of these rich families help one another, and they're not just isolated. None of them are working alone.
No, they're joined together in an allegedly racketeering organization that I call LUNA UNIT, you see, because you need a large number of people to place the weapons. You see, it wasn't David Rockefeller that put or disguised incendiaries as insulation and put them inside buildings 1, 2, and 7.
Right.
They would have had to have used people working in construction and demolition. Right? Because one of the things that the forensic economists, that's what I try and teach people who are intrigued by this technique, sometimes we call it Captain Sherlock, this analysis. If you look at the assets, whether they're criminal assets or public assets flowing through an enterprise, the easy ones are, or relatively easy ones, to follow are the money and the energy and the materials. So, for example, atomized aluminum powder was used by, I think there were 16 or 17 Unabomber alleged attacks, and all but two used atomized aluminum powder, which is an ingredient used in fireworks to produce the very hot temperatures and exhaust gases to drive the fireworks, right?
Right.
So, Ramzi Youssef in the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, he used 100 pounds of atomized aluminum powder.
So the FBI was supposedly involved in helping him, and the FBI was stopping him.
That's right. I think you're right. And the Clintons managed to infiltrate saboteurs inside the FBI because there were 50 senior FBI people deployed to clean up the laborers' union in 1995, and you could argue, well, the FBI got inside the laborers' union. I would argue the converse. I think the laborers' union, which we know was mobbed up, got inside the FBI.
Well, so then there's somebody within the FBI, but then see, this is where Michael Chertoff might have, I think he was the one who was in control in 1993. I can't remember. See, then you run into what is his role?
That's the problem with the virtual private network and this concept of tunneling, because what you can do with encrypted virtual private networks is you tunnel it into a regular system, like the global information grid used by the American military to maintain communications between the president, the vice president, and regional combat commanders, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If you have a group of traitors inside that information grid that has been equipped with encrypted virtual private networks, they can be most of the day talking with everyone they're supposed to be talking and doing exactly what is normal. When they switch over to the encrypted virtual private network, they literally disappear, even though they're in the network. From the point of view of the president or the vice president of the United States, they don't know that there's a communication going on that is actually designed to undermine or sabotage the Republic itself.
The guy at the top
may know the least, actually.
So you're saying Chertoff may not really know what's going on. Other people may be sabotaging him.
The purpose of bringing the people into the lawsuit is if we can get the principles behind the creation of virtual private networks and the concept of tunneling with encryption into regular networks, then we can ask them, or they can try and demonstrate to a jury why. Someone told me a few days ago, what a judge can do is they can demand of a prospective defendant to show cause why they should not be hauled into court.
I have that 1 minute again. What I'll do is I'll call on another calling card again.
I don't know. My voice is getting a little tired. Yeah, I don't know if you wanted to.
I wanted to thank you, David Hawkins, for the most astounding interview, a marathon of an interview. And,
well, thank you.
We'll be having another interview, I hope, with your friend as well, Captain Phil McConnell, if he...
Well, I think he would compliment... because he sees, as an ex-fighter pilot, an ex-airline pilot, and I think I asked that question before, isn't it absolutely amazing that the mainstream media has, very few exceptions, ever interviewed a pilot?
Well, that's what I mean. What is with this media? This media is...
Well, exactly, because they don't want to interview a pilot, because a pilot, as Phil McConnell will tell you, what he's able to do, and there's an incredible clip on HawksCafe.com and Captain Sherlock, of him performing the lowest, fastest refueling in the world at 180 feet. It's an astounding video. I think it's about 20 years old or whatever. So this guy, Captain Phil McConnell, has flown faster and lower refueling. Therefore, he's uniquely qualified to say whether or not it's possible for a human being like him to fly at 10 feet above the Pentagon lawn at 540 miles an hour. And what he'll tell you, and I think he's got far more credibility than I as a mechanical engineer have, he would say it can't be done.
Well, that's right.
And if it can't be done, just like Sherlock Holmes says, exclude the impossible, then it wasn't done. So whatever it was that flew that thing across the Pentagon lawn, it wasn't Hani Hanjour, an Al-Qaeda operative.
Oh, I know, it had to be computer controlled. But see, that's why it's this, the investigative reporters ignore it. That's what's so bizarre. They are protecting it fiercely and attacking it.
And you know why, Eric? They're terrified.
Well, then the terror...
Because what you've got here is a virtual... Sorry, a virtual murder-for-hire network that operates... And it's embedded deeply within the different arms of government in the United States. And I'm quite sure this conversation and the interview is being monitored. And what they have to do, the principals, is they've got to work out the relatively threat level. For example, if they took you out, or Ladybug, or me, what the risks to the overall conspirators are, from because it's going to get a lot more excitement, versus the individual risk of eliminating a voice which threatens them.
Right.
Now, in most cases, fortunately, we've been able to get to a critical mass with Coast to Coast and your show and Alex Jones and so on, and I believe now there's probably at a minimum 10 million people in North America who are aware in some substantial sense of these connections of the dots, if you will, and that there's a relatively small number of people, 100 I would say, that need to be taken down with the wrongful death suit. So they got a real problem now, because anything they do is going to reveal more to them than they're really comfortable with, including possibly threatening any one of us.
Right, I know. It's going out all over the world. I can't stop it with this internet and DVDs. And
so I'm very, very grateful for your interview. You know, you've said you're honored to interview me. I'm honored to be interviewed by you because you've given me a huge amount of time and space to put my story together. And I don't know how big your audience is, but I would guarantee if we continue like this, you'll have a significantly larger audience than if you'd never given me this time and Phil McConnell the future time to tell our story.
Right. Well, great. Nice talking to you.